This is WHFR Dearborn. Live in the studio now is our public affairs show, and we call it the new WHFR Journal. Local news and alternative views. This is the new WHFR Journal. Thank you and welcome to the show. My name is Jay Koronick. I'm station advisor here at WHFR FM as well as host of this show. And I'm joined in the studio by Dennis Reimars, returning from personal business. He's our news director here. Hi there, Dennis.
Hi, Jay. How are you?
Great.
Good to see you.
And also Ned Apigian. And how are you doing today, Ned?
Not bad for an old guy.
for an old guy.
Okay, at least we have their microphones on. That's
right.
That's
always
a step ahead.
You might regret that.
Folks, if this is the first time you've ever tuned in, well, welcome. What have you been doing for the last 20 years? In any event, we cover local news. Very, very local. We are the most local radio news show on the air, I think, in the Detroit area. We cover Dearborn and the surrounding area. That means the politics education issues, certainly, as pertaining to this rather specific area. And if you're actually listening on the internet or outside that area, you may find a lot of cautionary tales here that you might learn something, because a lot of the small communities and what matters to you most, we truly believe here, is what is right next door. And so if we're right next door to you or not, a lot of our stories have that import. First off, we wanted to just sort of follow up on, since the papers did, the story that we actually broke in terms of local media. Imagine that, we broke a story on local radio last week. Well, it was afterwards on WDET, but it was announced last week, Friday, that about $40 million would come from federal government stimulus money for the specific purpose of improving the rail lines, rail transportation in Michigan. The question was, and we knew it had to do with train stations, and of course the Dearborn station, and then there was Troy, and what's the other
Battle
one?
Creek.
Battle Creek, yeah. And Battle Creek and Troy need renovation, and Dearborn, it's not really renovation. We wanted to move the whole thing a little further into West Dearborn, a bigger plot of land, make it an intermodal hub where we have trains and buses and cars, more easy access, maybe another train line or two so that some trains could maybe park while other ones are going through. The cost of that project was estimated a few months back at $30 million. So the question that the newspapers, both the Press and Guide from last Sunday, January 31, and the Times-Herald from Wednesday, February 3rd, is how much of that is going to come to Dearborn? We want a whole new station. That would cost $30 million. Now, Public Information Officer Mary Landros is referred to on the front page of the Times-Herald from this last Wednesday. She's, again, public information head at the city of Dearborn. She said the station should be up and running in 2 years, and they believe that we're going to get all of the $30 million we need to make that new station happen, whereas Novi and Battle Creek, it's just renovations, wouldn't be costing that much. So that's very exciting, but the details of the grants haven't been finalized, and it says here that there is some confusion between agencies as to exactly what is receiving funds. It should be who is receiving what funds out of that $40 million. But we know it's $40 million, and Dearborn is one target. So we are certainly here recommending and hoping that we do get the whole new station. And I thought, really, for a $30 million complex like this with new train lines and so on, 2 years before it's done? 2 years? That's amazing. I think it'd be 2 years before we see the money from the federal government.
Right.
Who knows? But, I mean, that's wonderful if that really can be true. I read last week, as they were hoping to get the money, that this project will go into 2025. that we're at least 15 years away from having a new station and high-speed rail.
That's now, the high-speed rail.
Yeah, well, the high-speed rail could be added to this new train project at any time, but we need a new train station and the physical space to put one in.
Right.
And so there's been a few dollars given out nationwide for high-speed rail. We're in the consideration in the future, but we didn't get the first money for high-speed rail in Michigan. But certainly that corridor between Detroit and or Dearborn and Chicago, we're like the next move for federal money, you know, the next chance.
That will be the first one. I forget.
It's crazy, but if I remember the map correctly,
Florida.
Well, there was two or three spots only in the whole U.S., and one is definitely going to go in Chicago, St. Louis.
That's more important than Chicago, Detroit?
Well, whatever criteria the government uses, I think it's because it's going to cost less. I know the train line from Chicago to St. Louis. Used to ride it many times with my parents. It's right more or less next to 66. It's a straight shot. And there's a lot of land already that the train people own. In Michigan, for example, there's these little, you know, if you go through some communities, whether it's Battle Creek or whatever going west, there's not much extra land for a brand new track. You're going to have to cut down trees. You're going to have to move warehouses. You're going to, I don't know, the U.S. government might own the land, they're going to have to make room for it. But next to the train line from Chicago to St. Louis, I think there's a lot of empty space.
I drove it to Oklahoma, and you're right.
Very flat.
Exactly.
And there should be plenty of space to add a high-speed rail there.
I would think so.
So I'm sure the government is looking at, well, we have to demonstrate it works. We have to get it started somewhere. And let's start with the spot that's easiest to install, that costs less money.
Sure.
But I think the good news is, from what I saw on the national map, is that this line from Dearborn to Chicago is like the next time they do funding for high-speed rail, we'll get the money for that. I don't know how many years away that might be, but it's wonderful if we really are going to have a brand-new intermodal train station in Dearborn in 2 years. However, maybe Mary was misquoted. Maybe she was talking about something else, like the money will be here in 2 years, and then it'll still take 5 years or 10 years to build it. I don't know. I mean, that these things happen when you're reporting news like this. Unfortunately, the big if is, are we really going to get the whole $30 million out of the $40
million? Well, and you know, they're really optimistic. And one of the people quoted in the article that I'm reading is a Tim Hefner, and he's the administrator of the Michigan Office of High Speed Rail.
Right.
And basically, he said this: some of this money is, in fact, because of the long-term plan for the high-speed rail. In other words, they're already planning that, the Pontiac to Chicago deal. So, no, I mean, that's why they're so, I don't know if they're convinced, but they sound convincing that this will be funded completely.
I think we had a very good plan that we submitted. And
very good.
Of course, it will help business and commerce in this area, and we desperately need that. Yeah. That had to be another factor in awarding the money here, although $40 million drop in the bucket. And as I said, from Michigan, it doesn't specifically allow for high-speed rail yet, but we're very close to getting to that, and they do think that the Chicago-Dearborn line, and then the sort of Dearborn-Pontiac. I mean, it's very interesting to me. They don't usually mention Detroit in this.
No, they don't.
But the line does run to Detroit. Sure. But I don't know that the Pontiac line is going to be connected with Detroit or connecting with us.
They said Chicago-Pontiac is the actual line that would be the high speed.
But they're not going to go directly there, no.
It's
going to come through us first. And I don't know. What are they going to run through? Put a line north through Henry Ford Community College here. You know, I mean, there's no land here, so they really have to go to Detroit and then veer left to go up to Pontiac,
right.
I think. But it's strange that in all the maps and all the discussions, the actual name of the city of Detroit is not mentioned in these rail plans.
I never thought of that.
But Pontiac has to sort of go through that area because they can't go north from here. There's no train line at all. There was a train line from Detroit to Pontiac, and then they tore it all out. So I bet the land is still there somewhere.
Right.
They just have to redevelop it and put the track in again.
There's a station in Pontiac.
Mm-hmm. It's a major station.
Yeah. Where does it go?
Does it connect to Detroit?
It has to.
Okay.
I don't know. It's exciting. This stuff.
It's wonderful. I mean, especially what it could mean for Dearborn.
I'll give you my professional planning opinion about what you're
talking about. We want to let you know, Ned Apigian, he does have, besides being a working architect and many, many big projects there.
An all-around great guy.
He also has academic credentials, a master's, no less. And I can say this because he's very humble, in city planning, of all things. Go ahead, Ned.
Usually when you take something from one place to another, you know, it's got to end someplace for some reason.
That's weird. We'll just keep on going.
I could understand why you'd want to. Detroit's an important hub, and I don't care what you call it, Dearborn or Detroit.
Well, eventually there'll be some buildings and people living back down there, you know, around the train station, too, I would think.
This is not nothing.
It's got to be a stimulus for Detroit.
New to me. I can remember more than 30 years ago working on projects in downtown Detroit. Supposedly there'd be a station, and the point is to go to the airport. No one mentioned that. Now,
right.
What do I need this station for if I can't come here, park my car, and take it to the airport?
It's in the article.
Yeah. Well, if it's in the article.
When that line is improved from Chicago to Dearborn, including our new station, they're going to put that little stop there at the airport.
No, I imagine, I'm talking about the right now, since you're...
I know, now.
In order to develop a high-speed rail, it's not a matter of having the area. The whole bed of that track is completely different than a normal train. No, in order to develop that, it's going to take a long time. It's going to be very expensive.
And they don't have the money for it, but they are going to improve the tracks we have and put a stop at the airport and in Ypsilanti, apparently, too. I remember that. Before we get to high speed. So,
That's the encouraging thing locally, that people can take some way to come down Southfield, park their car, go to the airport.
Detroit is one of the major cities or major metro areas that doesn't have an inexpensive way to get from the airport to downtown Detroit or any of our conference centers like in Dearborn. You have to have people drop you off or pick you up. The taxi contract with Metro Taxi a few months ago, I found out, was not renewed. And now you only have a limo service at the airport, and they charge about $10 or $15 more to get to Dearborn now, and there's no other choice for a taxi-type service.
When they had the taxi, I didn't pay that much more. It was a couple dollars more for a decent car instead of a ramshackled cab.
Mm-hmm. Right, and you can still get a local taxi here and have them take you to the airport for the usual taxi fee, which right now is about $30 from Dearborn.
Is it?
Yeah. Well, with tip. And if traffic is not too heavy. But the limo is about $10 more to get from the airport. Now, you could call, the taxi, and it's not an ad, but the taxi service in Dearborn, they used to be called Dearborn Cab, and I think their actual name is something else, but you can look it up.
Lorraine Cab, isn't that the name of the company?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They're in
Lorraine.
That's Lorraine, on Warren Avenue.
Right. Mm-hmm. But they will come to the airport to pick you up if you call them, but you got to wait an extra 20 minutes for them to drive out there. They don't charge you for the way out.
You can do that now?
Yes.
Okay. Well, anyway, let me finish the thing about the high speed. The high speed or the train connection, which used to be you could take a train called the Empire State and go to New York. This connection, no matter if it goes from St. Louis to Chicago and probably Chicago to Kansas City, it's got to come to Detroit. It's got to go to Cleveland. It's got to go across the state. It's got to go to New York to tie with the north-south line that goes already has excellent service. Otherwise, they're pieces that don't connect. The thing that's going to create the synergism for development in the whole North corridor of the United States is to do that. Now, but for $30 or $40 million, I want to go to the airport now in 2 years. You're not going to go anywhere in 2 years.
I don't know.
Where am I going to go? How many? If I go to Ann Arbor, where am I going to go to Ann Arbor? Most of us,
Ann Arbor, Chicago, a lot of money, and in fact, Mayor O'Reilly mentioned this last time we talked to him here, and we're going to have him back in April, hopefully, for an extended interview on the Journal, after we hear the State of the City address, too, which is coming up sometime, we're not sure when, sometime soon, from Mayor O'Reilly. However, he said that he rode the train to Chicago in the last year or so with his family, and it's a cool thing to do.
It's four hours long. It's five.
Yeah, but when they get to the Indiana line, out of Michigan, there's all this stop and go, and it really slows everything down. I mean, you're only maybe 50, 60 miles from Chicago, and it seems like forever. Maybe that's two hours of the 4 or 5 hour trip right
there. The answer to that is simple. You have another train that does that local stop, and then you have an express that goes right into
Well, apparently you don't have enough train lines to make room for the express or something, and that's in the budget. That's part of the stimulus money that's going to Indiana and Illinois, is to eliminate that bottleneck.
Okay.
So even though it won't be high-speed rail, the trip, especially from our new station, maybe in 2 years, the trip from Dearborn to Chicago should be faster, no doubt about that. And it could maybe take an hour or two off the time, even with the standard rail, because, as Ned recommends, they'll be able to get an express train to go through there without all the little stops. The local trains will have their own stop, and that's fine. But apparently, they got some bottleneck, and the national money specifically is addressing that. And they don't have to in Michigan, apparently, but in Indiana and Illinois, that loop south of Michigan Avenue, of Lake Michigan there, that's where the bottleneck is, and that's going to be taken care of.
Because it's a developed urban area. We're not confronted with that. But you know how trains work, don't you? The line that goes to Siberia from Moscow is on one track, but every once in a while, you can pull a train off on a side.
Right. I mean, to make room for the one coming down. Yeah, you need those.
You don't need to have a complete those triple or quadruple lines.
Those little resting tracks, side routes, just for temporarily. I actually drove a road like that in Scotland. Scotland has, in northern Scotland, I know who can get there. It's an expensive trip, but in northern Scotland, it's just rural, and they have one lane roads to go from one city to another.
Wow.
And so what you do, I rented a car, and they said, just go like hell as fast as you can go. And when you see a car coming at you from the distance, you got to pay attention to these little side areas. Like every 2 or 3 miles, there's an area where you can pull off to the side.
Parking area.
Well, not to park, but to let the other person go through.
I mean, it looks like a parking
area. You remember where that was. Every time you pass one, you got to remember how far back it is. And when you see this other guy coming at you at 60, 70, 80 miles an hour, and you're going 60, 70 at him, you both usually have to, and it happens, slam on the brakes and negotiate who's going to back up to that little side area to
right
pull
away,
off.
Who's on the on the right?
No, you're both coming head on.
It's called
the one lane.
It's a game of chicken. That's what it is.
Yeah, and it's, you know, the heavy brush, whatever they call it, on the sides, and there's no gravel on the side that you can pull off to. So they actually have little paved areas that you can move aside. But you have to back up to get there. You know, the car is facing you.
Oh, man.
You negotiate who's going to back up to the last one. He said, it was only a mile back here. And he said, oh, it's 2 miles back on my side. You got to back up. So then you back up. It slows you down a little bit. It's very exciting going real fast with the other car coming straight at you. And then you got to figure, now who has to stop and back up here?
Right.
Fortunately, trains are supposed to operate on a computer.
Yeah. Well, they don't have to really worry about if they can see the guy coming in. So wait, I have to ask you one question about this, because this fascinates me.
Yeah.
Can you see them that far away where that you would have that?
Yeah, it's not too curvy. It's fairly straight.
We're talking about a clear day.
Not in the fog.
Well, the Scottish fog, that's another question.
Exactly.
It was kind of like that for a while in Canada. Some road I drove up to Stratford up there, it's a three-lane road, three lanes, which means the center lane is passing, but it's passing for east-going and west-going.
Wasn't Michigan Avenue like that for a while?
Well, it's hilarious because, you know, you're going 60 miles an hour, and then you see the other guy pulling out all of a sudden to pass, coming at you, and then you got to scoot back or slam on the brakes, and they eliminated that. They made it, I don't know, just two lanes or
they made it logical.
Whatever. It's hilarious. But anyway, we're going to have fun with the train station report. I think it's great, and we didn't mention it last week because I didn't know about it, but on campus yesterday and today is a peace conference, also called Teaching Conflict Resolution Conference, and Dennis has the story on that, and we also have an interview we want you to listen to, because imagine resolving conflict through negotiation and understanding, love and compassion maybe too, and not having to kill anybody. Imagine. It's got to be cheaper. And you don't lose any loved ones either. You get to grow to have a natural death. Imagine that. I know. I'm a pacifist, and I get crazed over any sort of conflict that leads to injury or death. I don't think any of it is justified. What about self-defense? Well, okay, I know. There's minor exceptions, but the Iraq War and Afghanistan War was not self-defense. And patriots out there can get upset over that, but think about it. Neither Saddam nor the Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan were in the process of attacking us. And Al-Qaeda, even today, is only about 100 of them in Afghanistan, and yet we're spending, besides the money we were spending in Afghanistan, we're going to spend another $33 billion there. You know, those drones cost a lot. Every time we send them into the mountains and remote control video game consoles, you know, blow up another one or two, it's about $500,000 a drone, something like that. You know,
but so, that's a fun video
game. Oh, yeah. Let's go to war with drones. That's so much fun. We want to do that all the time, don't we? Except we can't afford it. You know, 60, as I said last week, and we had a listener that was upset too, but over 60% of our national budget goes to war. The so-called Defense Department.
It's called National Defense.
Well, that's what's interesting.
And it's more than all the other military budgets of all the other countries in the world put together.
Combined.
So that's, combine Russia's military with China's military, big China, and with France and England and, you know, even Canada's got a military. Well, put all those budgets together and it's not as much as our budget.
Do you know the Canadian...
Why do we need all that much money for so-called defense? Well, we don't need it for defense. We need it for all these wars that we get into. And these last two... were not for good reasons. You might say, well, we thought Saddam had weapons of mass destruction. No, he didn't. I didn't. I read. I studied. I listened to the UN survey teams that had been there for 10 years. He didn't have any, folks. All that information that Bush and even Colin Powell went in front of the UN and tried to have the slideshow about where we think the missiles are and the nuclear stuff, he's in his autobiographies. Last couple of books, he said, I knew that we were lying. I knew there wasn't the evidence, but I was told by my president to make the case as if there was. In other words, he forced me to lie because that's why he didn't stay with George W. Bush. That's why he quit shortly after that little debacle that got us into the war. He knew there was no hard evidence for that. Well, there might be there. You know, we didn't know where they got them from. I mean... But, oh, my gosh. Anyway, folks, tell us about the conference, Dennis, and then we'll play the interview you did with the key speaker.
Well, and what you said, what makes it so interesting is I spoke with David Smith and Noor Kadar, both of the United States Institute of Peace, an entity, an organization I'd never heard of before. And I asked him, I said, is that
I interviewed one of those guys once. Remember Joachim Pau?
Did you, from the Institute of Peace?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, they're kind of under the radar, and he said a lot of people don't know about them. They are, in fact, funded by Congress, and they initiated in 1984, I think he said. We'll hear.
Just Connecticut?
No, they're in Washington, D.C., and they're just absolutely fantastic people. And what they had to say was this great message of education and dealing with things on the level, even as early in people's lives as secondary school or college, and that's why they were here. Fascinating people.
Got my microphone on here. tell us about the U.S. Institute for Peace. Is that a nonprofit? Is that funded at all by the U.S. government?
It is. It's the Institute of Peace, and it's funded by Congress.
Okay,
and in fact, the groundbreaking was done, and they have a new, beautiful building. You showed me pictures of it. I'll show you later. They're right off of the mall in Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. As he said, outside of the interview, they've been bouncing around office to office to office, and now they finally said, you know what, this is working. Let's get a more permanent situation.
Yeah, I mean...
There are a lot of college professors that are on
That was his background.
That's who's in there.
I mean, we have all the history classes in the U.S. pretty much glorifying war, especially the winners. And the Department of Defense looks like it's mostly Department of Offense. Mm-hmm. I mean, because of all the wars going on.
The defense
and
budget.
It's been suggested for many years that why not have a Department of Peace? Well, we really should just have one department. It is the Department of Peace, and their major activity should be conflict resolution without killing people. And there, you say, well, talk won't do it. Yeah, it can if you know how, and it's more than just talk. There's sanctions, so-called economic sanctions.
Isn't that what the UN is supposed to do?
And political image issues. You can manipulate other countries' opinions, and you can manipulate trade, which is part of the sanctions. And so, I mean, there's all kinds of things you can do and be successful at it. But peace is tough. Conflict resolution is not easy.
Oh,
it's not taught in schools.
Well, it should be, according to Mr. Smith. You know, and the thing in my question, and here's how my mentality was, and a lot of us might feel this way. You go in, and I asked Ms. Kadar, because Mr. Smith handles things on the domestic side, and she does more international conflict education. And I said, well, do you go into countries and you tell them, look, this is what you need? Kind of thinking, well, from the outside, you see that they need it, so you kind of tell them that they do. She said, no, we don't do anything without being invited. We don't do anything without them saying, come in and help us. And then even then, we have to help them draw the answers out. So it made a lot of sense to me. Right. Peace does, anyway.
Wow. Hillary Clinton.
Maybe it'll catch on.
You think?
She was at the National Prayer Meeting, which was televised recently. Mm-hmm. Gave a very interesting comment just about this subject, but she put her finger on really the problem. You're dealing with people that have, we won't call them ancient, but they're hundreds of years
antiquated
of misunderstanding and conflict between them.
Absolutely.
That you think you can.
It's conditioning.
She said, to resolve these issues is very difficult, and she mentioned it at the piece.
Let's go now to the interview that Dennis did with the two leaders of the U.S. Institute for Peace.
Of Peace.
And it was recorded yesterday, but the conference is still going on today.
Two
big days, and I think it was pretty much by invitation only. I know there's a lot of political science students from the college there, and I didn't hear about it, or I might have slid over there. I don't know. I didn't get the email or something. But anyway, it's a wonderful thing we're doing here. Very well attended. The large auditoriums here are packed, and teaching conflict resolution. Here's the interview that we just did on the journal yesterday. A couple little hums or buzzes.
Oh, absolutely.
Technical distortion, but hey, we're out there in the real world.
We did. We went to them. Yeah. We took the journal to the people.
Yeah, that's what do you want for nothing?
Yeah, okay. Well, take a listen to this 13 minutes of the people that really know about how to bring about peace instead of war. Take a listen.
David Smith and Noor Kirdar, is that right?
Yes.
And they're both from, both actually senior program officers with the United States Institute of Peace. Welcome.
Glad to be here.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much. I know we have a little schedule here, and I appreciate you taking your time on a break. Tell me a little bit, please, first of all, of what your backgrounds.
Okay. Well, I'm with the United States Institute of Peace. I'm a senior program officer. My background is I'm an educator originally. I taught in a community college for 15 years, actually. I taught in a community college in Maryland. And at the Institute, I focus a lot of my efforts on improving and building capacity in colleges and universities to teach about global peace and conflict issues. By original profession, I'm an attorney.
Oh, okay. And I think what you just brought up is it might be a good time to interject with you're here because of the a conflict resolution. Would you call it a summit, a seminar?
Well, it's a workshop.
A workshop
over 2 days where we partner as an institute with colleges and universities. Henry Ford Community College has two faculty members that are have been in programs with the institute I've known for several years, Dr. Anthony Perry and Dr. Mike Dare.
Excellent.
And about a year ago, we started talking about doing a program focusing on conflict resolution and peace building, where the Institute would contribute its expertise and work with Henry Ford and put something together, and that's why we're here.
Okay. And again, you taught at community college, and how did you get into this particular, I mean, this is a little different. I mean, obviously, there's conflict resolution,
right.
But how did you take this next step?
My background, I started as a divorce lawyer, if you can believe that. Many years ago, I was at that end of the conflict spectrum,
right.
Not personally, but as a lawyer.
No, but I mean,
happily married.
There's hand in hand there.
Right, I see that.
Sure.
And so I was very engaged in conflict resolution on the domestic level. I was in conflict divorce mediation. I was very involved in community mediation work, and then I really wanted to work more on international level and work with curriculum. So by a series of circumstances, I ended up at the Institute.
And so it wasn't a huge, I mean, it's a little bit of a different direction than you thought, but it's not a huge jump,
well,
I see.
And there are a lot of things that are similar. If you look at conflict kind of in a spectrum, you find that two people going through a serious divorce is not so different as Israel and Palestine fighting what they're fighting over. I spend a lot of time in my day telling my clients that sometimes the insight of mediating couples is useful in mediating international conflict.
Well, at its most basic level, both sides believe they're more right.
Well, they're more right. Both sides have different objectives they're trying to achieve. They're trying to often manipulate the situation to their ends they're trying to achieve. They're fighting over limited resources. Right. A place like the Middle East is always fighting over a limited water supply, land issues, and so forth. These are no different than domestic disputes.
Absolutely, you're right. Yeah. You're right. Yeah. Now, Noor, we know that David does, you had said, more on a domestic level.
Domestic.
And so you're more on the international side.
That's right. I work in the education and training international programs, so my focus is more on the international field. I do a lot of programs in Iraq and done in other parts of the world. And I also work on our distance learning courses. There are online courses that are available for everybody and anybody who has access to the internet. So we work on those courses, trying to reach out to people in that capacity, because unfortunately we're not able to go to everywhere we want to go with limited resources and can't reach out to the people who need the kind of resources that we're able to offer them. So live training kind of has its limitations, and that's why we offer the online courses, which I work on as well.
Is there a situation ever where you know you're needed, but you may not be as welcome as you would like? In other words, you know that you're needed, but somebody else may not realize how needed. Does that make sense?
You mean we feel that they need us, but they don't see that?
Well, I guess what you had said, that there's places that sometimes, because of limited resources, you can't go. And I wonder if sometimes there's a situation where you can't just walk in and do your thing, that there may be obstacles in the way.
Well, we never just walk in and do our thing.
Okay.
It's always we work with local NGOs. We're always working with people that are local there who request or kind of have a relationship that they need that kind of services that we're able to provide.
Okay.
So we go to them. We are not out there to try to impose our thought and our agenda onto. It's a very much coordinated effort, and we're there to really help give people the tools that they can use in terms of helping them solve their conflict. So even when we go to places, we don't tell them this is the way and you got to do it this way. On the contrary, we go and say, well, what are your needs and how can we give you some tools that you can use in order to better your lives and your situations?
Okay.
And they then are able to take what we give them or amend them to whatever they can, how they can use it. We don't have the answers. We never pretend that we have the answers for them. Right. They have the answers. What we try to do is help them realize what they are.
Bring it out, maybe.
Exactly.
Sure,
exactly.
Sure. And then so you give them options, probably, I would imagine.
Yes, and we try to, work with them and help them help themselves.
Just one step back. Listeners may not know, NGO.
Non-governmental organization.
Got it. Okay. No, and of course, I knew that. I just
Well, in the United States, I don't think we're cognizant of the need of NGOs around the world. I think we live in a society where you have not-for-profits and civic organizations. They kind of operate. We take them for granted. But in many parts of the world, especially in those societies that are failed states where there's very serious conflict, really the NGO is the answer to stability within the environment. And so a lot of our work is with NGOs, with what we call civil society organizations, to create stability, to create capability within those groups, to then support the kind of the government, we would say, and the other processes that we take for granted.
Again, everything coordinated. So.
Right. Yeah.
Now, but the United States Institute of Peace is not, in fact, a non-government organization, is it? This is a little bit new to us.
We're a very uniquely established and structured organization. We were established by Congress in 1984, and we were established as an independent, nonpartisan entity. We're not part of the executive branch of government or the legislative part of government. We're independent, like the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, if you will.
Okay.
We're funded by Congress, directly
good
by
example,
Congress.
By the way.
Yeah, yeah. funded directly by Congress. Our base budget comes from Congress. Comes from nowhere else, and that actually is good because it's not like other organizations have their hands in us. I always say we're funded by U.S. taxpayers because that's ultimately who's funding us. The wisdom of Congress in 1984 was to set up an entity that would focus on helping to resolve international conflict, but not looking at military options, but looking at training and education, looking at raising the intellectual capability of societies, looking at these other approaches that often are not the highest priority all the time, but
sure.
for us that they are.
So it's not surprising that we hadn't heard of the okay.
Right. No, it's not surprising because for most of our 25 years, we've worked in international arenas. We're not a very big organization, so I always remind people of that. We're probably between contractors and employees, we're probably around 300.
Less than
300.
Yeah, probably about 200.
200. And we have a base budget of about $30 million. Now, it's million, not billion, not trillion.
Right, right.
We're dealing with trillions now, you know. And in Washington standards, that's very small.
Yeah.
And there have been these comparisons. And I don't know the exact comparison, but people would say, well, what does it cost a day in the war in Afghanistan? And it's more than $30 billion a day. We're funded for a year at $30 billion a day.
Million
years. $30 million.
$30 million.
$30 million. Thank you.
For
yes.
1 year.
There,
okay.
Yeah. Yes. So it's we're not funded highly. Yeah.
Now you were here in June
right.
at Baker College in Auburn Hills, but you're here at Henry Ford Community College, right where we are right now. The mm-hmm. campus. This is kind of a big deal.
Mm.
What brought you here, and what are we hoping to accomplish?
Well. First of all, this is a collaborative arrangement between Henry Ford and the Dearborn Public Schools. And
okay.
I want to emphasize that we work in secondary education and higher education. Secondary education, we work with teachers, we work with students. We have a national peace essay contest, which several thousand students every year enter. So one of the things that we liked about this model was, in a way, if you're going to teach about peace and conflict resolution, you want to continue it seamlessly all the way through an educational environment. And if you can work in an environment where students from Dearborn Public Schools are going to Henry Ford Community College, they can have the same experience in high school they get in college, then it becomes much more part of who they are and
absolutely.
Part of their identity. So this was a great opportunity for us to come here and support both the school system and the college and what they're doing. And what we're hoping to leave is with there's a notion of developing maybe a peace and conflict studies program here. And there's an Arab cultural studies program here. We want to be able to support them, provide new tools and resources so that those programs blossom. And one of the things I want to mention is Dr. Gail Mee, who's the president of the college, and Dr. Gail Scheckman, who's the assistant superintendent of school system, were both here this morning. And they both, I talked to both of them. Actually, Dr. Mee spoke and said how important this type of program is to the Dearborn community, and I want to acknowledge that kind of support that is going on.
It is. It's awesome, and you've been in a lot of different areas, and I'm sure that you appreciate just how diverse this area is.
Yes,
incredibly diverse.
Yeah.
And just the fact that you're bringing that education.
Yeah.
I have children. One goes here. My son goes here. And my daughter is in Dearborn Public Schools.
Right.
And this is the kinds of things that I think they're ready for this. Absolutely.
Yeah.
So moving forward, and you did show me this. This is something I want to bring up here, the breaking new ground.
Right.
Will you tell me a little bit about this?
Okay. For 25 years, we've operated in office buildings in Washington, and which a lot of Washington organizations do. But several years ago, the president of the Institute was given some very astute advice by a member of Congress, and president is our Richard Solomon, and he was told, you know, you really need to get in bricks and mortar. You really need to have a place. And I think at that point, through his workings and his effort, we were able to get a piece of ground that's adjacent to the mall. There's not much land less adjacent to the mall. So I guess 2 years ago, we broke ground and we're building a national headquarters. This building is going to be, it's going to represent, first of all, America's commitment to building peace around the world. It is going to be a living, working monument. There's going to be a global peace building center, which is going to be an education center that will be part of it, that young people and tourists and teachers and internationals can go through and learn about the work of peace building and the contributions of very important people, but contributions of you and I,
sure.
say, understanding the sources of conflict. So it'll raise the capability of all people who are dealing in the peace and conflict field. It's been a real effort for us, and we're very excited. The building will open in the spring of 2011, and then I think about a year after that, the Public Education Center will open up.
That's awesome.
So if you go to our website, www.usip.org, you can see the building in its development and see the stages of the building.
And that is, I was just going to ask you for, it's what is it
now? www.usip.org.
That's wonderful. We're speaking with Noor Kadar, and Mr. David Smith, both senior program officers with the United States Institute of Peace. I know you're getting ready to go back out there, and I just appreciate your time. I thank you so much in sharing sharing what you're doing, this important message with our listeners. Thank you.
Glad to be
thank
in Dearborn.
Thank you for having us here. We really enjoy working with this diverse group of people because these are the type of people that we also work overseas. So it's a great experience to work with them here locally as well.
And I think that's amazing, just the people coming out. I mean, that's the first step, isn't it?
Yes.
Them being out there, and then after that, it's a learning process that we can all use.
Right.
Thank
you
again, and enjoy the rest of your stay here.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Well, we hope you learned something about peace. That's right, peace. P-E-A-C-E. It's a radical concept. It's where you don't kill each other if you have a problem. You don't try to resolve conflict by eliminating the other person. You know, we're the only species we're one of the few species on this planet. We're supposedly the dominant, intelligent, smart, civilized ones, right? But we kill each other in large numbers. And other species, that's right, other animal groups called a species, don't do that. They value, now some of them kill like crazy other species, but they value, and so do we.
Well, that's because they got to eat.
Okay, Ned.
That's because they got to eat. It's
right.
A different thing.
Yeah, and we kill animals to eat, and we kill plants. But we kill all kinds of things, other species, but so do other species. But we're uniquely violent towards our own selves and our own type of persons. Of course, we see differences. Oh, you know, they have different color skin, or they're taller, or they're shorter, or they live in that strange place across the sea, or something, you know, or they have a strange belief. Oh, scary, let's kill them. And I'm exaggerating, but really, when you get down to it, there aren't a lot of good reasons why we should be killing other human beings. And there's not a lot of good reasons why human beings should be as angry as they get at other human beings. There's ways of resolving. They're always going to have differences. You're going to have problems. You got to find answers, and you got to work together. So how to work together. And so this is just one step, I don't know how it was. I have a feeling that this conference was organized by our political science department. Do you know that they invited and they planned this?
No, actually the cultural studies department. So that would have been...
cultural studies. Okay.
Arabic cultural studies. I want to pronounce his name right. Mr. Mike... Dare.
Okay. Yeah, D-A-H-E-R. He's right. In the English department, but he's helped organize several multicultural, diverse activities on campus. And that's right.
He was a real catalyst for this.
Yeah,
sure.
He's a great guy. I've known him when I was English department instructor in my previous life. Yeah, before I was reborn in telecom many years ago. But, congratulations to Mike Dare for pulling this together. I know Anthony Perry, I was thinking his name too, that he and the political science department have participated by providing students.
He was part of it, yes.
Other activities. And so it's a collaboration here of faculty at Henry Ford Community College, and it's somehow they got the money together to bring in the United States Institute of Peace people. And you know, this has got to happen more. It's got to happen more. You can't just keep glorifying war and giving kids video games and say, okay, the way you come out on top with more points or winning the game is to kill as many of these aliens as you can. Sure, it's always aliens, right?
I'd like to say something profound about this. I was thinking
please.
About it on my own.
I'm ready. Please. Are we ready? Profound. Here comes Ned.
I need my pen.
Okay.
Okay, great.
Yeah,
no, it's very short.
Okay. Go.
I think it's in the nature of the human being. You go back to the Cain and Abel story. There's only two people, and they couldn't get along, right? So then when you go from one culture to another, whether it's Carthage and Rome, and you have these civilizations, one has to always try to dominate the other.
Sure.
You go through all of history, whether it's the British Empire, the Ottoman Empire, and then you go to the Middle Ages when the whole empire central government system was disbanded. You had little lords and little vassals all fighting with each other, all trying to take something from one another.
Okay,
and
it's totally
extremely... I was thinking about that, and I said, why this nature?
Well, it looks like it's almost genetic. It looks like that we have this, maybe it's the way our brains are set up, but it's hard to control our primal brains, which are largely emotional.
We have larceny in the heart. That's the problem.
Yeah. It's this murder impulse, and it's been written about and talked about in many different ways by anthropologists and who have looked back and tried to understand it. But that's the challenge for us as a species. Yeah, we got it. We have to use our brains, that is our rational logic ability, and train ourselves maybe every day
to overcome this.
Yes, to overcome this basic primal urge to kill people like ourselves. Just because it's our natural state doesn't mean we have to keep killing each other, because that won't end well, finally. So that's the process of civilization, is to get away from these really base motives. Now, even some religions would say, and I don't necessarily agree, is that we all have original sin, which means the evil is in us, and to attain heaven, if you believe in such things, the Western Judeo-Christian ones, and even the Muslim religions to a certain extent, you have to transcend your basic urges, which were put there by evil forces, or were inborn or something. And however you say they're there, scientists would say that it's been proven right from the caveman days, even cannibalism. I mean, even not just killing for war and dominance, but even eating our own, the body and blood of Christ. Sorry, that's a different thing, different metaphor. But the cannibalism thing is there in our past history, and we have to resist that, and we have to try to be better and overcome it. It's easy to let our primal natures direct us to kill rather than take the time to work things out. But has been proven by even your show, Then and Now, Ned, which is coming up again, I think, in March. So we're waiting for the next forum episode of Then and Now. That Ned, in surveying with professors back in history, it's pretty clear that we have, some ugly past to redeem ourselves beyond. But nonetheless, we can move ahead. We can change for the better if we understand who we are, basically, and put ourselves to work. So, okay, gonna switch here, and I'm in control of the microphone, so I can do that, folks. By the way, you're listening to the new WHFR Journal. The opinions expressed here are not necessarily those of anyone else at Henry Ford Community College. Although today, about peace, I think there's a lot of people saying the same stuff in the next building over.
And certainly not the president.
College. We don't want to put words in anybody's mouth, and they don't tell us what to say either. This is ironic, and we always cover alternative views and things that you don't normally hear about, not because we believe them necessarily, but we want to challenge you. What do you think? Jack Lessenberry is one of the few people, and he writes in Metro Times as well as elsewhere, and he might still be on Michigan Public Radio at times, but Jack Lessenberry, this week in the Metro Times, his editorial opinion is two cheers for Governor Granholm. Now, I don't know anybody that listened to the State of the State address that said anything good about what Governor Granholm said. In fact, she only covered one or two limited topics, not the whole range of issues like Asian carp or whatever, but that was her issue. Well, here's what Lessenberry said, and I'm just briefly introducing this to you, and you can read it in Metro Times this week, a free publication, by the way. Governor Granholm, two things that she said on two key issues. Number one, she came out strongly in favor of holding a convention to rewrite Michigan's now broken constitution. You know, her term is up this year, but in November, the voters, all of us in Michigan, will, by constitutional provision, are going to receive the question, should we convene a constitutional convention to review and amend or change or keep what we have as a Michigan constitution? The big ideas, the big changes that a lot of people are saying we might need will probably best be done this way, because there's too much politics, infighting, gridlock, and so on in Lansing.
How was this able to get on the ballot? Who was behind it?
The Constitution says that every 10 years it must go on the ballot. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Nobody has to take a petition out. It'll be on the ballot. It has to be this year.
I was just wondering who was pushing it.
And then the people in the state of Michigan have to vote in the majority, or the voters have to be in majority after that election, that yes, we should do it. After that, people are selected. And it's a process, and it can be a little bit political, but supposedly good, objective people will be put together a group, and then they'll have, I think, a year or two to review the Constitution and make recommendations. And they'll make, collectively, they'll vote, and they'll make a recommendation to the public, I think within 2 years of this fall, to the people of Michigan, to accept what they recommend. They could recommend, oh, everything's fine in our Constitution, keep it what we got. They could recommend some changes. They could recommend radical changes, amendments, and then it comes back to us, and we say yes or no to what that committee, that constitutional convention group, recommends.
Do you remember when the last one was, Jane?
It was at least 10 years ago. It's 10 or 12 years. It's a cycle that's in our state constitution
now. I know,
now,
but I remember there was one in 1962, I think.
Yeah. Where they actually
had a convention.
But I think the last time it came up, it came up, they decided not to do anything.
Right.
I don't think there were any changes the last time around. But yeah. So anyway, what's she recommending? She thinks we need to look at term limits, like get rid of them, reduce the power of special interest lobbyists, eliminating term limits would in fact do that. Change the regressive tax structure we have, and some people say, well, she's been there 8 years, why don't we just do it? But gridlock of Democrats and Republicans can't do anything about really taxes or save the budget. Some people have suggested unicameral would make more sense. In other words, not House of Representatives and a Senate in Lansing, but just one House. So you have groups of committees, one House passes it, goes to the governor, yay or nay. And so you don't have that two different bills on the same issue that are slightly different and have to be negotiated.
Where is that done now?
Washington, D.C.
Okay. We do have unicameral state government.
Oh, yeah. I think it's Nebraska or somewhere out there.
There's a couple.
Yeah, they work. They work. They cost less money. Fewer people get elected, but the costs are lower.
Too.
And they're part-time. Right. That's another issue is do we need a full-time legislature when, in fact, they don't meet for 3 months a year. They don't meet on Fridays, typically. And the whole budget crisis usually happens at the last minute every year anyway.
Right.
So why not just go part-time?
They're mimicking the federal system, which makes sense in the federal system when it was all organized then.
FYI to our listeners, and I really shouldn't use acronyms because we're radio, for your information, this week is it the Times-Herald or Press and Guide? The editorial from the Kalamazoo Gazette.
Times-Herald
from this week. The Kalamazoo Gazette editorial that they use as their Times-Herald editorial this week, with attribution, of course, suggests that our legislature should get up some of their fancy benefits for health care, and because every person doesn't have them, in order to save money. Well, maybe they should. And sort of an op-ed for that, and I can only mention it briefly, and I'll come back to the Lessenberry article here for Jennifer Granholm's second recommendation, is for you to read in full. And see, you got an assignment now for next week, folks. Can't just listen to the radio. You have to go out and do something yourself. In the Press and Guide, from this last Wednesday, February the 3rd, Nabil Abraham, who is a teacher in the area, in fact, he's a professor here at Henry Ford Community College, head of the Honors Program, too. Wonderful statement by him, an opinion about, should we really talk about reducing the pay and benefits of public sector jobs? So look at his argument, okay? These are the people that we depend on the most, police, fire, teachers. Should we take away their benefits? Should we lower their pay? Shouldn't they be some of the highest paid in the state? I know, how can we afford that?
The reason is they're paid by taxpayer money. That's where the pressure comes from.
Yeah, I know there is. Well, you know, there have been a lot of editorials that we've seen in the local papers to cut the pay and benefits of public sector jobs in Michigan. Whatever you think about it, you should read Nabil Abraham's point of view, which says don't do that. That would be wrong. Of course, his bias is he's a teacher. He just wants to see his own.
He's getting some of that money.
Yeah, but yes, if teachers were some of the highest paid, like, and I agree with you, Jay, what you suggested, imagine the competition that would create, and then we'd have the best of the best.
We do for our K-12 teachers, and it's not great pay in terms of other jobs in Michigan, but we have the third highest pay rate on average for K-12 teachers in Michigan.
It's not like it used to be 30, 40 years ago.
Well, yeah, 30, 40 years ago, I had the choice of teaching in Michigan or not. I grew up in Michigan. I said, well, you should stay in Michigan and teach here. I had the choice of going to some of the state, but I said, well, why not stay here? A lot of good things in Michigan, yeah. But they also pay almost the highest. Why would I go to Texas and get half the pay?
Really?
Half the pay on average to be a teacher. So already that the pay scale, but people are suggesting cutting what we have.
Right.
Not increasing, but I mean, cutting what we're going to lose, as Dennis mentioned, going to lose a lot of good talent, whether they're already in Michigan or considering coming here from Texas or somewhere else, if we do that. Same problems with police and fire. Now, back to Jennifer Granholm, the second cheer that Jack Lessenberry gives to Granholm is that she did make a very, very tough government reform proposal that could happen now. And this is the guidelines. He said, if this doesn't happen, we're going to have a massive train wreck here in Michigan. Now, that's an unfortunate metaphor with the improvement of the rail system, but that's a metaphor, massive train wreck for government. Yeah, he doesn't mention here, and Granholm didn't mention either, that between $1.6 and $2 billion in debt, that's the state of Michigan, starting July 1st. How do we get a budget for the state of Michigan? You know, October 1st is the final deadline, but the budget year actually starts July 1st, and she says we got to get one by then, and we can't wait. It hurts the schools. It's mess in Dearborn with additional layoffs and that. So here's her proposal, and a lot of people may be mad. But number one, give state employees strong incentives to retire, just like in the school district. If you can get people out at the highest pay that they've earned over years of advancements, improvements, you can replace them with people at lower pay. It's an easy way to save money, even though you pay for the pensions.
Does the math the work on
yes,
that?
Yes, it does. Yes, absolutely, positively. The average person who doesn't do the math thinks, oh, you give that early retirement money to teachers. You know, that's costing a fortune. You know, no, it works out. Over, I think it's just 3 years, and then they're making a profit. It's a little tight. It's like breaking even for a couple of years.
Well, that's what Ford does. Automakers, that's what they did.
Yeah, but it's just a lot of boards of ed, they don't want to do it because the average taxpayer will say, oh, you're giving them a tremendous gift there, and it's costing us. No, it breaks even because you're hiring people that are starting out at lower pay. Secondly, she says that would save the state, by the way, millions of dollars and create some new jobs when those people retire. State workers, she says, under this proposal, will have to pay a bit more into their pension funds and pay part of their health care premiums. Well, that's not good. It cuts their benefits, but that's part of the answer, too, because health care going up so much, you got to cut health care benefits if the state's going to balance. State retirees, which includes me, moi, would lose dental and vision coverage. Now, that's costing me, under the state-subsidized plan, I am retired from Henry Ford Community College, and as a teacher, that coverage is, it's only about $10 a month. I mean, that's all I pay. But if I had to pay it for myself and the state didn't subsidize it, who knows? It could be $100 a month or something unbelievable.
Well, the vision's not a big deal.
No, dental and vision
is something, but I don't have it myself. I can't get my wife to buy it, and she's spending $200 a month at the dentist.
Right, yeah. But she also says, here we go, and like that editorial, current lawmakers would lose their lifetime health care coverage.
Thank God for that.
And Senate Majority Leader Mike Bishop, Republican, he has not been willing to give it up. So it's interesting that conservative editorial that says the lawmaker from Kalamazoo says lawmakers should give up their... Mike Bishop, Republican head of the Senate, doesn't want to give it up. Well, for him, I mean, he doesn't want to lose his lifetime health care coverage.
Yeah, absolutely. But he's going to give up his job pretty soon.
Hey, folks, you know, teachers don't have lifetime health care coverage. We've got to start paying for it now until we get to Medicare. Like, everybody gets to Medicare, age 65. You still got to pay, right, Ned? But
it's not free.
No, it's not free, but it's subsidized tremendously, and so most people can usually afford it. Some people might not be able to. Dennis?
What about universal health? Oh, sorry.
Well, that's a different issue.
No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, well,
if we all had universal health, then
we wouldn't be talking about
it. We would be like
this.
Japanese. Everybody gets insurance, and you're paying for it someplace.
And Canada, and France,
and
Germany.
And the rest of the world.
Sure. Right.
One way or another.
Nobody pays up front. Nobody pays any money for the universal health care in those countries. Nobody pays for prescription drugs in those countries. But
and it's cheaper.
Their taxes are higher, but the system works. Like Medicare, as I found out yesterday, for people 65 and above, even though we do pay in, those people that get the benefits, they still have to pay in $100 a month or more per person for the coverage, but they get a really good plan that has only 1% overhead. 1% overhead. You don't want to call it a profit necessarily, but, you know, improvements in the system. Whereas the private health insurance company has a 30% overhead, 30% incredible profit margin. So that's why costs are going up, is because profits keep wanting to go up from our private companies. There's absolutely no doubt. You say, well, but we got the best healthcare system in the world, but most people can't afford it. Okay? And that's a shame. That's an ethical crisis, a moral crisis. And those people that say, let the poor just, you know, get sick and die, where are you coming from? Obviously, you're not a practicing Christian.
I am eat cake, too.
Yeah. And I'm not recommending Christianity. I didn't say that. But even a practicing Buddhist, even Tiger Woods, would probably say it's not a moral decision to let people that can't afford insurance die. Okay, that it is a collective societal responsibility. Every other so-called civilized country in the world, you know, with any high standard of living, agrees, and here we are. And everybody admits the number one cost that's out of control in this country is health care. And the number one answer, which even Obama has not gone over to this side, is single payer. The single payer universal care is the best answer. Although, I'll just mention, we got to conclude now. We got just a few seconds at the end of the WHFR Journal. Last night on The Daily Show, I know it's Comedy Central, but a serious interview with Representative Weiner from New York City. He represents New York City to Washington, D.C. Close friend of Jon Stewart, the host, too, from youth, in fact. But, you know, you could listen to that. He says the simplest thing to do here, you talk about public option, even. Obama's even said, and the House bill had a public option. The simplest thing to do is just reduce the beginning age for Medicare to 55 from 65. That'll help a ton of people. It's an efficient system. Just do that. You know, that if you don't want to go to a universal single payer, which is the ultimate cost saving and the ultimate best way to run the system, and we don't have the best health care in the world. I'm sorry if you think we do. If you have a great plan, well, fine. But the best health care system for everybody in the world is in France. Okay, we're seventh. I don't know who's in between, but we're seventh in the world by all objective criteria and analysis of all the aspects of our health care.
Some of that includes the finance, right? Would that be part of the criteria?
Well, the access to health care, of course.
Exactly.
If it's totally free, then you get a top rating on that chart that people don't have anything to pay. It comes out of basic taxes and government budget.
Right.
You know,
lucky to be seventh then.
Right. Well, I guess. Right. Yeah, I guess.
You could be called a socialist, you know. That's a dirty word.
Ned wasn't here a couple of weeks ago. I went over this, folks. Open up your civics books, your government books from high school. Socialism is not evil. Socialism is not Hitler. Socialism is not Mussolini. Socialism is not Russia. Marxist-Leninist Russia. That's communism, folks. And Hitler and Mussolini were fascists, folks. Look it up. We are about 25